to the Kill Radio Weekly News. I'm your announcer, DJ Shy John, here in Los Angeles. This edition of the Kill Radio Weekly News being recorded on Tuesday, January 7th, 2014. In the top of the news, I bring you the Harper's Weekly Review. Also dated January 7th, 2014, the Al-Qaeda-affiliated Islamic State of Iraq and the Levant ISIS took control of the Iraqi city of Fallujah and parts of Ramadi following an attempt by Iraqi forces to break up a camp established over a year ago in Ramadi by Sunnis protesting the country's Shia-majority government. Some tribal militias in the region initially fought the Iraqi army and struck a deal with the government and began fighting ISIS. Other militias allied with the Iraqi army defected to fight alongside ISIS. Iraq regained control of some of Ramadi, and Prime Minister Nouri al-Maliki called on the people of Fallujah and its tribes to expel the terrorists. "Who are the terrorists? This is a fight," said U.S. Secretary of State John Kerry, "that belongs to the Iraqis. A coalition of forces opposed to the regime of Bashar al-Assad, including the tribal Awakening Movement and the Al-Qaeda-affiliated Nusra Front, launched an offensive against ISIS positions in northern Syria." "This is Guantanamo," shouted a prisoner from the Islamic Tawhid Brigade after being freed from an ISIS prison in Raqqa. Julian Assange's father defended a WikiLeaks party tea with Assad in Damascus as a matter of good manners. Palestine's ambassador to the Czech Republic, Jamal al-Jamal, was killed in Prague by booby-trap safe. The head of al-Qaeda in Lebanon, Majid al-Majid, died of kidney failure in Beirut. And ISIS claimed responsibility for a suicide bombing that killed four people in the Beirut neighborhood of Haret Creek. "I think we are witnessing a turning point, and it could be one of the worst in all our history," said Lebanese novelist Elias Khoury. "The West is not there." The Associated Press revealed al-Qaeda to be modeling its bookkeeping practices on those of a multinational corporation, and to have documented such expenses as $1.60 for mustard, $200 for a trip for spreading propaganda, and $3,720 for 20 barrels of diesel to fuel a power station in Timbuktu, entrusting brother Abu Bakr with guarding, selling, and looking after the barley next to the river, read one receipt, $3. Muhammad al-Ansari, read another, 34 buboos. As the clock struck midnight on New Year's Eve, Dubai set off 500,000 fireworks. 100,000 Ukrainians sang their national anthem in Kiev to express their desire for integration with the European Union. And Latvia adopted the euro. "We've got adult diapers," said a 14-year-old who lined up at 10 a.m. to attend celebrations in New York City's Times Square. "We're wearing them right now." Seattle student Beautiful Existence completed a year of eating only at Starbucks. And Hawaii's Transportation Department changed a policy limiting names on driver's licenses to 35 characters and issued a card bearing the full name of Janice Key, I'm not going to read it, whose surname translates roughly to "one who would stand up and get people to focus in one direction when there was chaos and confusion and help them emerge from disorder." Harry Marshall Rock, I'm not going to read that one either, was elected president of Madagascar. Walmart recalled donkey meat sold in China under the label Five Spice because it was contaminated with fox meat. Chinese police seized 3 tons of crystal meth in the village of Bashe, and Iraq War veteran Sean Azaridi of Denver made the first legal recreational cannabis purchase in the United States. "Today I was fortunate enough to be the first recreational cannabis purchase in the world," tweeted Azaridi, who bought a pot truffle and an eighth of Bubba Kush. Bill Clinton swore in Bill de Blasio as the 109th mayor of New York City. Frost quakes struck Ontario, and a polar vortex of Arctic air struck the Canadian prairies and the central and eastern United States, causing temperatures in the Minnesota towns of Babbitt and Brimson to reach 40 below Fahrenheit and in Embarrass to reach 37 below. I told Embarrass to call back and do better, said a National Weather Service forecaster in Duluth. The U.S. Coast Guard cutter Polar Star was dispatched to Antarctica to free the icebound Russian research ship Academic Shokaiskili and the Chinese icebreaker Snow Dragon, which became trapped after evacuating the Russian crew. The United States transferred the final three Uyghur prisoners held at Guantanamo Bay to Slovakia. They are persons, said the Slovakian Interior Ministry, who have been neither suspected nor accused of the crime of terrorism. Sudanese President Omar Hassan al-Bashir, who was under indictment by the International Criminal Court for genocide, flew to Juba to try to broker a peace deal in South Sudan, where rebels killed an army general who was en route to recapture the city of Bor. John Kerry left Jerusalem after 4 days of failed negotiations to restart the Israel-Palestine peace process, and Israeli settler communities released a video in which an actor portraying Kerry offers a porcupine to a man who has run out of toilet paper. "Are your workmates mocking you?" Kerry asks a man in a tutu. "We have a solution for you, a resignation letter eloquently articulated on chrome paper with passion fruit and mango scent." A quarter of surveyed British men who had made New Year's resolutions to lose weight said they gave up by January 2. Scientists debated whether an increase observed in the mass of Earth when extrapolated from GPS satellite orbits was due to dark matter around the equator. And an Indian Trail North Carolina plumber named David Waddell submitted his resignation from city council in Klingon script. "Perhaps today," wrote Waddell, "is a good day to resign." This article written by Jeremy Keene. And now next on the news, I want to bring you an article from www.slate.com. Inside the Box: People Don't Actually Like Creativity, by Jessica Olin. In the United States, we are raised to appreciate the accomplishments of inventors and thinkers, creative people whose ideas have transformed our world. We celebrate the famously imaginative, the greatest artists and innovators from Van Gogh to Steve Jobs. Viewing the world creatively is supposed to be an asset, even a virtue. Online job boards burst with ads recruiting idea people and out-of-the-box thinkers. We are taught that our own creativity will be celebrated as well, and that if we have good ideas, we will succeed. It's all a lie. This is the thing about creativity that is rarely acknowledged. Most people don't actually like it. Studies confirm what many creative people have suspected all along. People are biased against creative thinking, despite all of their insistence otherwise. We think of creative people in a heroic manner, and we celebrate them. But the thing we celebrate is the after effect, says Barry Staw, a researcher at the University of California, Berkeley Business School, who specializes in creativity. Staw says most people are risk-averse. He refers to them as satisfiers. As much as we celebrate independence in Western cultures, there is an awful lot of pressure to conform, he says. Satisfiers avoid stirring things up, even if it means forsaking the truth or rejecting a good idea. Even people who say they are looking for creativity react negatively to creative ideas, as demonstrated in a 2011 study from the University of Pennsylvania. Uncertainty is an inherent part of new ideas, and it's also something that most people would do almost anything to avoid. People's partiality towards certainty biases them against creative ideas and can interfere with their ability to even recognize creative ideas. A close friend of mine works for a tech startup. She is an intensely creative and intelligent person who falls on the risk-taker side of the spectrum. Though her company initially hired her for problem-solving skills, she is regularly unable to fix actual problems because nobody will listen to her ideas. "I even say, 'I'll do the work. Just give me the go-ahead and I'll do it myself,' she says, but they won't, and so the system stays less efficient." In the documentary, the September issue, Anna Wintour systematically rejects the ideas of her creative director, Grace Coddington, seemingly with no reason aside from asserting her power. This is a common and often infuriating experience for a creative person, even in supposedly creative environments, in the creative departments of advertising agencies and editorial meetings at magazines. I've watched people with the most interesting, the most out-of-the-box ideas be ignored or ridiculed in favor of those who repeat an established solution. Everybody hates it when something's really great, says essayist and art critic Dave Hickey. He is famous for his scathing critiques against the art world, particularly against art education, which he believes institutionalizes mediocrity through its systematic rejection of good ideas. Art is going through what Hickey calls a stupid phase. In fact, everyone I spoke with agreed on one thing. Unexceptional ideas are far more likely to be accepted than wonderful ones. Stahl was asked to contribute to a 1995 book about creativity in the corporate world. Fed up with the hypocrisy he saw, he called his chapter Why No One Really Wants Creativity. The piece was an indictment of the way our culture deals with new ideas and creative people. In terms of decision style, most people fall short of the creative ideal. Unless they are held accountable for their decision-making strategies, they tend to find the easy way out, either by not engaging in very careful thinking or by modeling the choices on the preferences of those who will be evaluating them. Unfortunately, the place where our first creative ideas go to die is the place that should be the most open to them, school. Studies show that teachers overwhelmingly discriminate against creative students, favoring their satisfier classmates who more readily follow directions and do what they're told. Even if children are lucky enough to have a teacher receptive to their ideas, standardized testing and other programs like No Child Left Behind and Race to the Top, a program whose very designation is opposed to non-linear creative thinking, make sure children's minds are not on the wrong path, even though adults' accomplishments are linked far more strongly to their creativity than their IQ. It's ironic that even as children are taught the accomplishments of the world's most innovative minds, their own creativity is being squelched. All of this negativity isn't easy to digest, and social rejection can be painful in some of the same ways physical pain hurts. But there is a glimmer of hope in all this rejection. A Cornell study makes the case that social rejection is not actually bad for the creative process. It can even facilitate it. The study shows that if you have the sneaking suspicion you might not belong, the act of being rejected confirms your interpretation. The effect can liberate creative people from the need to fit in and allow them to pursue their interests. Perhaps for some people, the pain of rejection is like the pain of training for a marathon, training the mind for endurance. Research shows you'll need it. Truly creative ideas take a very long time to be accepted. The better the idea, the longer it might take. Even the work of Nobel Prize winners was commonly rejected by their peers for an extended period of time. Most people agree that what distinguishes those who become famously creative is their resilience. While creativity at times is very rewarding, it is not about happiness. Stahl says a successful creative person is someone who can survive conformity pressures and be impervious to social pressure. To live creatively is a choice. You must make a commitment to your own mind and the possibility that you will not be accepted. You have to let go of satisfying people, often even yourself. Jessica Olin is a writer and illustrator living in Brooklyn, New York. You can follow her on Twitter at Jessica Olien. And now one more for the news today. From the National Review Online. As a preface, I want to include this reading from Wikipedia. National Review is a semi-monthly magazine founded by author William F. Buckley Jr. in 1955 and based in New York City. It describes itself as America's most widely read and influential magazine and website for conservative news, commentary, and opinion. Although the print version of the magazine is available online to subscribers, the free content on the website is essentially a separate publication under different editorial direction. Now, that being said, here in the National Review Online, dated January 6th, yesterday, here's an article called "Sensible on Weed by the Editors." I notice nobody will put their name on it. Launching 17 million Rocky Mountain High jokes, Colorado has become the first state to make the prudent choice of legalizing the consumption and sale of marijuana, thus dispensing with the charade of medical restrictions and recognizing the fact that while some people smoke marijuana to counter the effects of chemotherapy, most people smoke marijuana to get high, and that is not the worst thing in the world. Regardless of whether one accepts the individual liberty case for legalizing marijuana, the consequentialist case is convincing. That is because the history of marijuana prohibition is a catalog of unprofitable trade-offs, billions in enforcement costs, and hundreds of thousands of arrests each year in a fruitless attempt to control a mostly benign drug, the use of which remains widespread despite our energetic attempts at prohibition. We make a lot of criminals while preventing very little crime and do a great deal of harm in the course of trying to prevent an activity that presents little, if any, harm in and of itself. Marijuana is a drug as abusable as any intoxicant is, and its long-term use is in some people associated with undesirable effects, but its effects are relatively mild. And while nearly half of American adults have smoked marijuana, few develop habits, much less habits that are lifelong. In another context, we might write chronic. Compared to binge drinking or alcohol addiction, marijuana use is a minor public health concern. All that being the case, the price of prohibition is relatively high, whether measured in police and penal expenses or in liberty lost. The popularity of marijuana may not be the most admirable social trend of our time, but it simply is not worth suppressing. One of the worst consequences of marijuana use is the development of saucer-eyed arguments about the benefits of legalizing it. Colorado and other states that may follow its example should go into this with realistic expectations. If the Dutch example is any guide, then Colorado can probably expect to see higher rates of marijuana use and the use of other drugs, although not dramatically so. As with the case of Amsterdam, Colorado already is developing a marijuana tourism industry. Some hotels are considering offering designated marijuana smoking rooms, even while smoking tobacco outdoors is banned in parts of Boulder, which brings problems of its own, among them opportunistic property crime and public intoxication. Colorado's legal drug dealers inevitably will end up supplying black markets in neighboring prohibition states. Expected tax revenues from marijuana sales will amount to a mere 0.3% of the state's budget. We'll have to see about that. The payoff is not in tax revenue gained, but in losses avoided. A great many people will avoid being convicted of crimes for a relatively benign recreational indulgence, and those criminal convictions often have much more severe long-term consequences on pot smokers' lives than marijuana does. The business of policing covert marijuana dealers has been replaced with the relatively straightforward business of regulating them in the open. A large and fairly nasty criminal enterprise has lost its raison d'être, at least so far as the Colorado market is concerned. Perhaps most important, the legalization of marijuana in Colorado and the push for its legalization elsewhere is a sign that Americans still recognize some limitations on the reach of the state and its stable of nannies in arms. The desire to discourage is all too easily transmuted into the desire to criminalize, just as the desire to encourage metastasizes into the desire to mandate. It is perhaps a little dispiriting that all of the abusive overreaches of government to choose from, it is weed that has the nation's attention, but it is a victory nonetheless. Unfortunately, it is probably too much to hope that Colorado's recognition of this individual liberty might inspire some popular reconsideration of other individual liberties, for instance, that of a working man to decide for himself whether he wants to join a union, or for Catholic nuns to decide for themselves whether they want to purchase drugs that may work as abortifacients, higher liberties, if you will. That was from the National Review, which is a conservative publication. Once again, we have reached the end of the Kill Radio Weekly News and Review. So please be kind to one another in the coming week and stay out of the news.